Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Flu season is just beginning and will continue to get worse as colder weather brings people into closer contact with one another indoors. The flu makes millions of Americans sick every year and kills thousands to tens of thousands. It is nothing to be taken lightly. A vaccination or flu shot is recommended for virtually everyone. Joining us today is Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thank you for having me back.
And just as a disclaimer, if you will, is that if you listen to this program on a regular basis, you realize that we get financial support from UPMC Pinnacle. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, I always look at this as kind of a preview of the flu season this year, the 2019 flu season. And one of the things that strikes me that I'm hearing about this year is Australia. And, okay, I made the connection that Australia has opposite seasons than what we do here in North America. But what did Australia see this year when it came to the flu, and how does that connect to North America, the United States?
So Australia had a very severe flu season, one of the most severe, or a little bit less severe than their season in 2017. It was an H3N2 season, meaning that the predominant strain circulating was the H3N2 strain. The H3N2 strain is usually associated with much more severe flu seasons. So in the average non-H3N2 season, there are about 10,000 deaths a year. In the average H3N2 season, there's about 30,000. So typically, this strain is associated with more deaths, more hospitalizations, people simply getting sicker. And Australia had both a season which had this virus as the predominant virus, and it had a longer season. Now, I think the quote is, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future, but the Australian season can predict the American season. The fact that we had a very bad season in Australia may mean that we have a very bad season here. In my mind, that's a good reason to prepare, do things like get your flu shot, because we're at high risk for a bad season. If you recall, we had a bad season last season, and we kind of have a feeling that it's just the flu. Last season, we had something like 50 million people infected in the United States. We had something like 500,000 hospitalizations, and there were 60,000 deaths. So when you have a bad flu season, you actually have more deaths from the flu than you have from car accidents, from the opioid crisis. It is, for most people who are young and healthy, a kind of benign illness. It comes and goes. People who are younger, less than 2 years of age, people who are older, more than 65, it's not an uncommon way to end up in the hospital. It's not an uncommon way to actually die.
You know, when I hear people say it's just the flu, maybe one of the reasons is that they confuse the flu often with just a cold.
Absolutely.
That the symptoms are very similar. What are the differences in the symptoms?
So first of all, there's a tremendous variation in how sick you get with the flu. There are people who just have a mild disease that can be mistaken for the cold, and there are people who get very sick. In general, people who have the flu have higher fevers, have more muscle aches and pains. They often feel sick. They don't just feel like they have a minor illness. On the other hand, there's a lot of overlap, and one of the reasons that, for example, people think the flu vaccine doesn't work, I got the flu vaccine and I still got the flu, is the flu vaccine has no protection against the common cold. The other viruses that are the non-influenza respiratory viruses that circulate during flu season at the same time. And those viruses can still make you sick. They are not as likely to land you in the hospital as the flu virus.
I mentioned in my introduction, and I wanted to do this on purpose, was to mention that one of the reasons that there are more cases of flu in the wintertime is not because of cold weather. Colder temperatures, well, indirectly it is, but people are in closer contact indoors.
Yeah, so people are indoors, they're close together, they're where they can spread the virus more easily. So cold and flu season tends to correspond when people are all packed together and can easily transmit viruses among themselves.
So cold weather has nothing to do, let's dispel this myth.
It has a little bit. Okay. The flu virus probably survives a little bit longer in cold, dry temperatures, so it is able to propagate itself more easily. On the other hand, the major factor is people being close together, people being packed together indoors.
Let's go back to Australia. I mean, we're talking about a continent, a country that is halfway across the world. Mm-hmm. There's a whole ocean separating North America mm-hmm. and Australia. Even though the weather seasons are opposite of mm-hmm. one another, since the flu is spread by contact, it would not seem to make sense that disease, if you will, that illness, mm-hmm. that virus, could be spread that far.
Well, the virus spreads kind of gradually and throughout the world. So it's a very connected world. Even before it was connected, the virus would spread from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere as the seasons changed. It just would take a little bit more time. But it's well known that the flu season in the southern hemisphere often, not always, often predicts the flu season in the northern hemisphere. So even though we literally have oceans separating us, there's enough travel, there are enough people migrating, there's enough people going from place to place that the virus really has no trouble spreading.
Australia is, you know, one of those countries that there is good medical care in
Absolutely.
Australia, so I'm sure that the people of Australia, when they contract the flu, are treated probably the same mm-hmm. as well as here in the United States. But what about some of those other Southern Hemisphere countries that health care may not be as good? What's their, I mean, do they have a higher death rate?
They almost certainly do, because when there is less health care infrastructure, there are usually higher death rates. So if you get very sick with the flu in a resource-poor country, you're worse off than if you get very sick with the flu in a country that has more resources. So like any illness, if you're in a country that doesn't have a healthcare system as good, you're going to have a worse outcome. Yeah. So I assume that the other countries that are poor, have less resources in healthcare, are going to have worse outcomes in the flu, like they do with most diseases.
Let's face it, most of the discussion, or maybe not mm-hmm. in your line of work, because you're dealing with people who are sick from the flu on a regular basis, but in the general public, it seems as though most of the discussion about the flu in the last few years has been about the vaccine.
Yes.
All right, let's kind of dispel some myths, answer some questions about the vaccine. First of all, is the flu shot safe?
Absolutely. So they've actually done this study. They've actually done a study where they give people the flu vaccine or a placebo, a shot of saline, a shot of water. And the only symptom that people have more commonly with the flu vaccine is a sore arm. They do not get fevers more frequently. They do not get any other symptom. They don't get the flu from the flu vaccine. When you actually give people saline, a sham shot, the only thing that happens more frequently is you get a sore arm. Now, there are very rare cases of something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, where people get paralysis, and that can happen from the flu shot. When you do the calculation, it is much more common to get Guillain-Barré, the paralysis, from the flu than it is from the flu shot. And your risks of getting severe reactions are actually much higher if you don't get the flu shot. The other thing to keep in mind is they've looked at high-risk people, people above the age of 65, people with heart disease, people with lung disease. And if you get the flu shot, your chances of dying during the flu season go down by half. So we have people that debate, well, is it safe? Is it going to give me the flu? It doesn't work. But the objective evidence is, if you're a high-risk person, your chances of dying during flu season are cut in half by getting that shot. In addition, roughly the same for children. Now, with children, they have a much, much lower death rate, much, much lower hospitalization than especially older adults. So it's a rare thing for someone, a kid to actually end up in the hospital with flu. But getting the flu shot decreases children's death rates by 50%. In addition, remember, kids are often little germ factories. So if you have older grandparents that the grandchildren are regular contact with, if you vaccinate your kids, the chances that the grandparents will get the flu go down, the chances that the grandparents will end up hospitalized go down. Flu, when people are more immune, any virus has a harder time spreading in the population. So getting the flu shot not only protects you, it probably protects the people around you. It probably protects your parents. It probably protects your grandparents. And it protects the population at large.
What does the flu shot actually do?
So the flu shot is typically two versions of the influenza A virus that's circulating, usually two versions of the influenza B virus in circulating, and it gives you pre-immunity. So it gives you immunity to the flu virus. Now, flu vaccine effectiveness rates generally are about 50-60%, meaning that if you get the flu shot, your chances of getting the flu go down by half. Now, many people think that just half the time it doesn't work. On the other hand, if you do get the flu, when you've had the flu shot, your chances of getting very sick go way down. So people who get the flu, even though they've had the flu shot, are much less likely to end up in the hospital, much less likely to die than if they weren't vaccinated. So the flu vaccine primes your immune system to fight off the virus, and if it doesn't work, it still makes it much more likely you're going to have a mild illness rather than a severe illness.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Smart Talk Road Trip returns to the Extraordinary Give in Lancaster on Friday, November 22nd, 2 weeks from tomorrow. Join us at the Holiday Inn of Lancaster Extraordinary Experience event, where we'll broadcast live beginning at 9 a.m. RSVP at WITF.org/events, supported by Roof Advisory Group. Today we're talking about the flu. Can I have a preview of the 2019-2020 flu season with Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, one thing I've always been curious about is, again, most of us think of the flu as a minor illness. Mm-hmm. And when you hear statistics of 5 million people, 50 million people getting the flu, you know, that's roughly 15% of the population.
Yes.
And maybe 50,000 dying a year, that's not a minor illness. But the question arises probably in many people's minds, when am I so sick that I need to go beyond just going to my family doctor, that it's time to go to the hospital?
So most people with the flu can be safely treated with just supportive care, Tylenol, fluids, and staying home. People who are in high-risk groups are a kid less than 2 years of age, above the age of 65, or if you have a chronic medical condition like heart failure, diabetes, asthma, anything that puts you at higher risk, we often give those people medications. We often recommend that they call their doctor. If you are sick, meaning you're having trouble breathing, you're having chest pain, You can't keep anything down. You're dizzy when you stand up. If you know something is wrong, that's when you should go to the emergency room. We actually discourage most people from the flu with going to the emergency room because we end up with a lot of people who could be treated in their doctor's offices, sometimes could be treated by phone in an ER. What we encourage is if someone is having what we would call an alarm sign, can't breathe, are confused, can't keep anything down, that's the time to actually go to an emergency room. Those are the people that you really want to treat, that may end up in the hospital. In addition, when people die from the flu, they don't often die from the flu. They often die from their heart failure, their asthma. But you can also get pneumonia after the flu. So someone who gets the flu, starts to get better, and then starts to get worse a day or two later, you have to worry that on top of the flu, they have what's called a super infection. They have a pneumonia on top of the flu. Those people should definitely see their doctor.
We have a question from Steve in Middletown that is similar to what you just were talking about. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Hi, Dr. Goldman.
Good morning.
I have a notorious problem. Almost every year I get a real nasty respiratory infection, kind of a bronchitis. If I don't go to the doctor immediately, I get a lot of fluid in my lungs eventually, and my PCP said, look, don't ever wait 7 days. You come in right away when this happens. I get on Augmentin and steroids. It's really bad. And he said, I want you to get a flu shot from now on. It's going to help. So my question is, what does a flu shot have to do with the bacterial infection, and how will that help build my resistance to not get this darn bug every year? Thank you.
So that's an extremely good question. When you get the flu, it actually predisposes you to a bacterial infection. If you think about it, there's all this junk in the lungs, and bacteria like to grow in that junk. And so a certain percentage of people who get any respiratory virus, not just simply the flu, get what's called a bacterial superinfection. So anyone who gets repeated lung infections, we strongly recommend the flu shot because we know that viruses can predispose you to a bacterial superinfection. And if I was your doctor, I would strongly recommend that you get the flu shot. I'd also look into things like pneumonia shots, which may be of help.
Next question from Dave in Lemoyne wants to know how the pneumonia vaccine relates to the flu vaccine.
So they're two separate things. The flu is a virus, so it's not a bacteria. The flu shot provides no protection against a bacterial pneumonia. The pneumonia shots that are out there are vaccines against the Streptococcus pneumoniae, the most common cause of community-acquired pneumonias. And so they provide protection against bacterial pneumonias. They won't protect you against the flu shot because it's a virus, and they won't protect you against other types of bacteria. But because the strep is the most common cause of pneumonia, they provide significant protection against a bacterial pneumonia. The two are complementary, meaning they together make it much less likely that you're going to get an infection. But the pneumonia shot doesn't protect against the flu, and the flu shot doesn't protect against pneumonia.
Someone who is susceptible to pneumonia, mm-hmm. by that I mean has maybe had it three or four times, mm-hmm. they get the flu. Are they more susceptible to getting pneumonia from the flu?
You'd have to know exactly. You would think so. You'd have to know exactly why they're more susceptible. Something wrong with their lungs? Is there something wrong with their immune system? But if someone gets pneumonias repeatedly, you know they're at high risk. You know that the flu can lead to a pneumonia. So it's a good idea to get both the flu shot and then probably both pneumonia shots.
Something you touched on earlier that I wanted to explore a little bit more, you said stay home from work. Probably stay home from school can be added into that. Why is that important?
You know, it's important because if people stay home, they are less likely to infect other people. And we've had a couple of and there's very kind of theoretical data that if people, you know, if you think about it, if I get sick with the flu and I stay home, the only person I can infect is my wife. If I go to work, I can infect a bunch of people. You probably, with social distancing, give some advantage to the types of the flu that make you just sick enough that you still go to work, the more mild forms, because they'll reproduce themselves more efficiently. They'll spread themselves more efficiently. It's a little out there. It's a little bit theoretical. But if you look at the worst flu outbreak of all time, if you look at the flu pandemic of 1918, where there were 100 million people worldwide that probably died of the flu, that was during the middle of World War I. That was when there were men in close proximity in trenches all through Europe, where there were men in the United States preparing to go to Europe, again in camps in close proximity. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the worst virus we ever had also occurred at the same time there were lots of people packed in close proximity, and the advantage was the virus that gave you explosive illness and infected everyone around you. So I always thought that social distancing, keeping yourself at home with the flu or other viruses, first of all, just simply prevents other people from getting sick. If you're at home, you're not giving it to everyone at work, but may provide some advantage to the milder viruses and keep us from getting the worst viruses.
But the problem is, and this goes back to another societal thing, that there are many of us who figure, I don't want to lose a day's work because I don't feel very secure. I want to be a good employee, a reliable employee. I must be there. No one else can do my job. That's part of it. Then you may have that boss who says, he's only got the flu. Why is he staying home? He's only got the flu.
So there are many companies that pay for their employees' flu shots because they know that giving the flu shot is cost effective, decreases absenteeism, decreases days off from work. Encouraging people to stay home will also keep them from getting other people sick, keep them from making other people take days off from work. Unfortunately, I can't solve the problem of society where we're all a bit workaholics and we all feel that we have to go in because no one else can do our job. And we sometimes have bosses that want us in because they feel no one else can do the job. From a medical perspective, it's better to stay home.
How do you keep from getting sick?
You know what? It's everything that your mother used to tell you. There is no magic pill. It's clear that if you get enough rest, that if you don't smoke, if you don't drink too much, your chances of getting any virus go down. During flu season, I try to wash my hands as much as possible because the flu is not only spread directly person to person, but if someone coughs on a desk, a doorknob, a light switch, the flu virus survives on that. And when you touch that desk, that light switch, that doorknob, you can often inoculate yourself. So most of us touch our faces, touch our about 10, 15 times an hour. So you touch that desk, that doorknob, that light switch, then you touch your face and you infect yourself. So one of the most effective ways to prevent the flu or any virus during flu season is just simply to wash your hands a lot, or even to carry hand sanitizer with you, because the hand sanitizer will kill the flu, it will kill the common cold. So things your mother used to tell you, get enough sleep, get enough rest, don't smoke, don't drink too much, all work. And good hand washing also works. In the hospital, you know, I probably wash my hands 50 times a day, and so I'm always doing that. But if you're not in the hospital, carrying a thing of hand sanitizer with you so you can squirt your hands frequently is a very good way of preventing the flu, a very good way of preventing any virus.
You said earlier that if you stayed home, the only person who could get sick would be your wife. In those situations where you do stay home, say there's a wife, there's still children at home, we all have said, oh, I don't want to get sick. I got to do something to stay away from you to get sick, to stop touching the same things. What can you do in your home?
So in your home, it's the same sorts of things. Good hand washing. Obviously, you shouldn't share kitchen utensils. You probably shouldn't share towels. And you probably shouldn't cough on your wife or your children. If you do cough into your hands and you do touch a desk, a doorknob, a light switch, you should wash that desk, that doorknob, that light switch off with a hand sanitizer, because the virus will survive on that surface for usually an hour or two.
You know, you talked about children being germ factories. Mm-hmm. I often tell the story that I can remember I can count them on one hand the times I got sick before I had children. Mm-hmm. Once we had kids and they would be around other children, that's when I got sick almost every year.
Absolutely. First time I got sick was when we had a kid, and first time I'd gotten sick in years. So the issue is the kids get, especially when they're at school, especially when they're daycare, they get exposed to a lot of viruses. They bring them home. And again, that's why vaccinating the kids protects the parents. That's why vaccinating the kids and the parents protects the grandparents.
Okay, so, you know, we use a blanket description, say the flu, mm-hmm. talking about influenza. But earlier in the program, you talked about the strain, and there are different strains every year. How is it decided which vaccine is most effective with which strain?
So what the vaccine usually has is is components that are most like the current circulating strains. And for example, they'll use the flu season in Australia to predict what will the flu viruses be here. The last two seasons, the predominant influenza A strain has been the H3N2, the one that causes you to get very sick, and the H1N1, the old swine flu, the pandemic flu. And so each year they use an H3N2 and an H1N1. And they try to make it as close to the strain they think is going to be circulating in flu season. It involves a little bit of prediction. Most of the vaccines now are so-called quadrivalent vaccines. They contain two forms of the influenza B. And again, they match the influenza B strains to the ones that are most commonly circulating, usually often using the data from what's circulating in the southern hemisphere.
There are people who will avoid the shot just because they have a phobia about shots. Mm-hmm. They don't like to have that sore arm. They don't like to see a needle. What about the mist? A flu vaccine that is not put into the body through a needle?
So the flu mist, which is now recommended again. There were some questions over its efficacy with H1N1. It has been put back on the market because the vaccine was changed slightly, so it should be efficacious. If I have, every year I get a flu shot, I don't use the mist. If I had a phobia to shots or I just couldn't take the shot, I would take the mist. If I'm given the choice between which vaccine to take, I always take the shot because it has a much longer track record and I think it has a much better record of being effective. If I had the choice between no vaccine and flu mist, the one that you inhale, I would use the flu mist.
Mm. You've talked a lot about how to avoid the flu altogether, but I think it's worth repeating. Number one, and I think I can speak for you when I say number one is to get that flu shot.
Absolutely.
But then what after that?
So after the flu shot, I think staying away from people who might be sick, encouraging your coworkers who might be sick to stay home, and then good hand washing, good sleep, good nutrition during the flu season, the things that are more likely to keep you healthy in general.
Well, that sounds like a healthy lifestyle all year round.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, Dr. John Goldman's an infectious disease specialist with UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, always good to talk to you.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our segment that we just completed on the flu is part of WITF's Transforming Health Project. For more information on the flu, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. James Buchanan, the only U.S. president from Pennsylvania, is also the nation's only bachelor president. Thomas Balcerski's new book, Bosom Friends, The Intimate World of James Buchanan and William Rufus King, describes the close political and personal relationship between the two men during their time in Washington. Joining us on the phone right now is Thomas Balcerski. Mr. Balcerski, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
All right. So just as I said in the introduction, Buchanan, only president from Pennsylvania, but what seems to be getting a lot of attention here in recent years is the nation's only bachelor president. But let's talk a little bit about William Rufus King. Who was he?
Yes. And for people in Pennsylvania, for your listenership, he's probably someone they've only heard in passing. He was actually from the South. He was born in North Carolina and later transplanted to Alabama, but he made his national mark while in Washington, D.C. as a U.S. senator and eventually obtained the office of vice president under Franklin Pierce.
So, by the way, I should mention to our listeners, if you have a question or a comment about James Buchanan, William Rufus King, the book, 1-800-729-7532. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. The title of the book, Bosom Friends, The Intimate World of James Buchanan and William Rufus King, sounds provocative, but it really warrants some explanation as to what a bosom friend was in the 1820s to the 1850s. What was a bosom friend?
Yeah, so bosom friends was a somewhat positive connotation. It didn't actually carry a pejorative, which is one of the reasons that I chose it as the title. It primarily meant a close relationship between one man and another man, and also between a woman and another woman, but it never crossed genders. Typically, a bosom friendship was one formed in a close physical setting, such as in a college dormitory, or perhaps, in the case of the politicians here, in a Washington boarding house. So it connoted domesticity, living together, sharing meals, being close to one another.
Buchanan and King were roommates, or messmates, as they were referred to then. Now, this was normal for bachelor members of Congress in Washington at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, for the most part, I can say that's right. Not just bachelor messmates, though. In fact, almost all Washington politicians in the U.S. House of Representatives or in the United States Senate lived in boarding houses and shared a mess relationship with other politicians. So the bachelors were not alone in this. However, what made it interesting and why Bosom Friends considers this relationship in detail is that these two bachelors self-consciously chose to live together in a mess on the basis of their bachelorhood. And in fact, they included other bachelors in the Congress as part of their mess. So it speaks to the idea that bachelorhood actually carried an identity and a sense of personhood that distinguished them from other members of the Congress.
Much of the attention on Buchanan in recent years has been on his sexuality and whether he was gay or not. Now, in your book, you don't come right out and say James Buchanan was not gay. But from what you describe in what you write, it does not sound as if James Buchanan was attracted to other men.
Well, Scott, you've actually really put the question in a really good light because you used the word attraction. That is, I think, one basis for historians to discuss this relationship on questions of attraction and less on questions of identification and orientation. The question of being gay today is one of orientation. That's our sort of understanding that one lives a life, is sort of born this way, to use a phrase that's popular, there's a whole set of lifestyle choices that are made that follows from this sexual orientation. With attraction as the mode of thinking about it, instead it gets to actions. And there we can be more concrete and measurable in how we look at the evidence. So yeah, I dismiss out of hand the idea that he was sexually oriented to a gay identity the way that we think of it in the 21st century. But I also agree, I don't actually see the attraction either. So in terms of attractions and identities, you're right. My basic premise of the book is it's not there, at least for Buchanan. I think it's important to note that the biography of Bosom Friends considers both Buchanan and King, and I do come to a different conclusion with respect to King.
Yeah. Okay. What was the different conclusion?
Yeah. I mean, with King, it's a different story. King certainly felt longer and deeper for Buchanan, and we find that in the written record. He also has a less well-documented romantic life in the sense that his early pursuits do not actually reveal someone seriously interested in courtship and marriage. That's not the case for Buchanan, who has a very well-documented romantic interest and continues to engage in courtship and flirtation throughout his life. So again, the preponderance of the evidence suggests that King actually felt for Buchanan in a way that Buchanan never reciprocated.
In the book, you say that whether behind their backs or maybe mm-hmm. even as part of political rivalry, that there were people who would make hints or drop hints about the two of them and their sexual orientation. In fact, with William Rufus King, there were people who called him Miss Nancy or Aunt Nancy. I mean, what was the significance of that at the time?
Yeah, that's a great question because it actually gets at something more than perhaps the sexual orientation question. It also gets at gender performance, questions of manhood and masculinity. And I think it's important to note that in this period, one's manly behavior and performance was judged as the primary way of representing oneself. So these hints of effeminacy that one hears in Aunt Nancy, Aunt Fancy, it's taking William Rufus King's manhood and subverting it. It's meant to attack his manhood. Whether it also carries a hint of sexual deviancy is one of the open questions, I think, of the time. By looking at other uses of the insult, I've tried to parse where it gets at a gender insult and where it gets at a sexual deviancy insult. But I would say generally it was meant to imply effeminacy, which again is a mixture perhaps of the gender and sexual insult.
So Buchanan was called the humbugger. Mm-hmm. Humbug, I associate with Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge, which, by the way, in the old movie, the first version of the movie, I'm thinking to myself, boy, that actor looked a lot like James Buchanan. But what was the significance of the humbugger?
Yeah, well, that was one of the many colorful insults levied against Buchanan. Buchanan was generally disliked by his rivals, which is to be expected. I mean, politics then as now is a series of rivals among individuals. And when Buchanan was insulted as the great humbugger or something else, it was a way of dismissing him as not a serious candidate for future office. What's interesting is he kept proving them wrong. He kept advancing in a way that his rivals truly came to hate. And he had rivals within Pennsylvania as well as within the National Democratic Party. One of the other insults that Buchanan had levied against him has to do, of course, with William Rufus King. And there again, this gendered aspect of the language of insult is interesting because he was referred to as Mr. Buchanan and then the additive, his wife, which refers to William Rufus King. So even in the gendered language of insult, getting back to my point about masculinity and manhood, Buchanan was often presented as, well, the man, and that makes King more feminine as the wife.
And by the way, we are not going to be talking just about these two men's sexuality. A lot of mm-hmm. politics, and they shared a lot of the political. In fact, that's probably the biggest focus in the book, is that these two shared a lot of the same political views, voted along the same ways in Congress. But before we go on to that, there were two letters between these men that have gotten much attention that people have pointed to and say, see, these men had to be homosexual because mm-hmm. look at the way that they spoke to one another. Now, I don't know if you can quote those letters exactly, but if you can, tell us about the letters.
Yeah, that's actually right. There are two letters, in fact, from the period May 1844, where both men are writing in a particularly intimate mode, and both letters survive. That's important. The fact that historians are able to look at them today is our first hint that at least future generations did not consider them suspect or worthy of destruction. Now, the backstory to these two letters is that Buchanan and King had been living together for 10 years in a Washington boarding house, and that King had been assigned to the new role of Minister to France at that time. Buchanan was left in Washington, D.C. as a senator. So the separation had just taken place. And therefore, it is not surprising that both men were expressing some kind of longing or some kind of emotion at their separation. So Buchanan, though, does not write directly to King. Buchanan instead writes to a female friend named Cornelia Van Ness Roosevelt in New York City. And that's important, too, because a lot of what's been said has been misunderstood that Buchanan was writing directly to King. So the quote, which I can read to you, it's long, but it actually does get at the point here. He writes, "I envy Colonel King the pleasure of meeting you and would give anything in reason to be of the party for a single week. I am now, quote-unquote, solitary and alone, having no companion in the house with me. I've gone a-wooing to several gentlemen, but I've not succeeded with any one of them. I feel that it is not good for man to be alone and should not be astonished to find myself married to some old maid who can nurse me when I am sick, provide good dinners for me when I am well, and not expect from me any very ardent or romantic affection." And the return quote, which is shorter, so I'll read it as well, is from King to Buchanan directly. And he writes, "I am selfish enough to hope you will not be able to procure an associate who will cause you to feel no regret at our separation. For myself, I shall feel lonely in the midst of Paris, for there I shall have no friends with whom I can commune as my own thoughts." And yes, those are the two quotes that have generally been cited, almost proof positive to this idea of a sexual relationship.
So taken in the context of today, if those letters were written today, it almost certainly would say that. But in that time period, that was the kind of language that men apparently showed more emotion toward one another.
Well, it's interesting, Scott. I think what Bosom Friend shows is that 19th century men did have a language of intimate expression that does differ from our own today. But that's only because the verbiage has changed. Intimacy is one of those words that has evolved since the 19th century to mean something different. Back then, it connoted a kind of connection, not so much of physicality, but more on an emotional level and on one of shared trust. It's not to say, though, that we don't have words and or men engaging in this kind of intimate relationship today. I mean, my book actually concludes with the idea of the bromance, the idea that you could have two men who have an affection for one another, could have a playful relationship, but it's non-sexual. What's interesting, too, in the context of Buchanan and King is the idea that today we have both straight men and gay men enjoying close relationships. Hopefully, one could imagine without problematizing sexuality as part of it. But again, that's where we're at today. And so it does suggest both a universal nature to the Buchanan-King relationship as well as something specific to the 19th century.
Buchanan was engaged to Ann Coleman, and many people here in central Pennsylvania will recognize that name, iron-making family here in central Pennsylvania. She broke it off because she actually thought he was flirting with another woman. Buchanan flirted with women, especially Southern women, all the time throughout his life. I mean, this is something I never expected as I'm reading your book. It's this guy, and he was constantly flirting with younger women.
Right. Right, and there's a question to what extent that was a so-called beard, and this is where sometimes historians of sexuality want to insist he was playing the game of courtship without any actual interest in following through on those courtships. I think it's more complicated than that. Buchanan has been described as a bachelor father, and it's important to note that he had a large group of relatives for which he was a caregiver, particularly Harriet Lane, his niece, and James Buchanan Henry, or Buck Henry, his nephew. He already was essentially providing fatherly duties to these young nieces and nephews, and the question almost was at that point in his life, would a mother figure affect that relationship with his nieces and nephews? And that's one part about it. I think another part is the social standing of a politician in Washington, to what extent it would be useful to have a wife as a politician. And part of what Bosom Friends tries to do is see, did bachelors actually suffer as politicians without wives in Washington, D.C., and how did they get around some of the social duties? And there again, the nieces and nephews helped to explain some of it. Harriet Lane ended up being, in a way, the solution to Buchanan's problem. She served as his social hostess, and then eventually as the first lady in the White House. And I think she really gave her uncle the necessary support that a wife would have provided.
How does a senator from a northern state like Pennsylvania and another senator at the time from a southern state like Alabama share the same political outlook when slavery was such a divisive issue?
I think for your listeners, they need to understand that slavery was accepted in both the North and the South. I think today it's easy to think that all Northerners were anti-slavery and all Southerners were pro-slavery. A more, I think, accurate rendering would be most Americans, the 90% plus, were protective of the slave system. It was the exceptional American, a sort of fringe American who was called an abolitionist, who actually stood up and shouted against the slave system. So in that sense, it's not too difficult to imagine that Buchanan and King shared a similar politics. But what really brought them together was an allegiance to the Democratic Party. Their relationship shows that party politics can bring men together from around the nation for both good and bad.
When you say that 90% and the 10% that were abolitionist, mm-hmm. Buchanan was not a fan of abolitionists, was he?
No, not at all. And his distaste for it grows as he ages and becomes president. And he will eventually blame the abolitionists for causing the Civil War. What's ironic, of course, is after the war, after history is rewritten, the victors, the so-called abolitionists now, who include many people who weren't abolitionists before the war, they'll turn the finger right around and say, no, the blame goes on President Buchanan.
Buchanan is often listed as the worst president in the nation's history because his actions or lack of actions that led directly to the Civil War. First of all, do you agree that he was the worst, probably one of the worst? And what did or didn't he do?
Well, those are great questions, Scott. I think on the worst question, it's a fun parlor game, but that's about it. Historians need to remember that best and worst only causes polarization. I could argue against Buchanan being the worst president. It's really not a productive exercise. The fact that there's a generalized view of him is where we're at. I will just say that. I don't personally believe he deserves that title, but again, I think it's a fruitless exercise. The fact, though, is his actions during the secession crisis is what has put him in that category. He is deemed to be passive and inactive. He's deemed to have been a pro-Southern supporter. And while my book does hint at all the ways in which he was, it doesn't necessarily mean a different man could have prevented the Civil War. It simply means that a different president could have done a better job as president.
In your book, you do describe often Buchanan as taking stances, positions mm-hmm. that are pro-Southern, though, right?
That's right. I see a lineage almost going back to his days in the Senate from when he met William Rufus King. And King's influence is key throughout, from his senator days to his president days, of a pro-Southern politics. Again, Buchanan himself personally did not want to see slavery expanded, but he understood the political nature of the institution and how it was important to the National Democratic Party. So in that sense, he's more a collaborator in the slave system and not a true believer. King, by contrast, benefited from the slave system, lived in Alabama, was a slave owner, and had a large plantation. He certainly had a much more racialist view of the institution and believed that it was a positive good, as did so many Southerners.
When that question I asked a little bit earlier about Buchanan and what he did or didn't do, when you say he could have done more, his point of view was that the federal government didn't have a great role in keeping states from seceding, correct?
Yeah, he had almost a strict constitutionalist view, which is interesting because he's most likened to Andrew Jackson in his political philosophy. And Jackson, by contrast, did bluster and bellow when it came time to stare down South Carolina during the infamous nullification crisis. And it's for that reason that historians say, aha, Buchanan could have followed Jackson's example and used the power of the sword to stare down the entire South during the secession crisis. I think 1832 and 3 was different than 1860 and 61. I think Buchanan was definitely not as respected or capable of keeping together the Union as Jackson. But still, that is the basis of the comparison. I do believe it's flawed. I think there are ways in which History is being flattened in that comparison, and yet it seems to be the consensus among so many people.
Well, that's just it. I mean, James Buchanan often is kind of mentioned in two sentences before you're talking about the Civil War, and there's much more to it, as your book points out. I want to thank Thomas Balcerski, author of the new book, Bosom Friends, The Intimate World of James Buchanan and William Rufus King. Learned a lot about Pennsylvania's only president. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Scott.